My name is Karen Blomquist. I teach at Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago. I'm the professor of church and society there. And this is my second week here in the village. Last week I did a series on work. And I'm doing a variety of things this week. But for the first three sessions of this week, the title is The Church Goes Public, with various subtitles after that. Today, The Church Goes Public, Why? And tomorrow we're going to be looking at a particular example of the church going public, namely through community organizing. And my husband, who's been quite involved in that, will be joining in that presentation tomorrow. And then the third day, the church goes public with what manners?
If you need cup or truck, please come.
It's working. A lot of people come to Holden, and what they discover when they come to Holden is that there's a lot of discussion here and a lot of presentations on the topic of various public issues in which Christians are called to be involved, whether those issues are peace or Central American issues or South Africa, issues of crime, such as the issues being discussed in the other room during this hour. And for many people, that's a new kind of twist. Those aren't always the predominant kinds of things that go on in local congregational discussions. They may or may not be, depending on where your church is at. Certainly, that whole matter of the church going public is not at all a new phenomenon. It's not at all a new phenomenon of the 80s, even though there's probably been more articles and discussions on that focus in recent years than has been the case for some time previously. But certainly, if we look back just in terms of our own national history, certainly in New England colonialism, there was very much that sense of the public presence of the church, and in various eras since then also. But I suppose for many, there is that kind of feeling whenever that phrase, the church, whenever the church somehow gets involved in talking about public issues or political issues, there's that kind of feeling of, well, I came to hear about the Christian faith, not to hear about politics, the usual kinds of phrases like the church and politics don't mix and all the rest. And I suppose we could say for the purpose of our week here, not only do we usually not, or do many of us have problems seeing the mix between those, but I suppose we didn't expect to even have a U.S. Senator in our midst for these discussions this week. So I think one of the things I've discovered in the time I've been here at Holden is that putting that together is something that we need to do in some ways that are going to be rather review and basic for some of you and maybe not quite so new for some of the rest of you. There's been a lot of hesitancy for Christians, and especially I think for Lutherans, to see the church getting involved in political or economic matters. I suppose our Lutheran problem has been especially one of avoidance of anything that might resemble politics. And that hesitancy to be involved because of our fear that the church will somehow thereby become tainted or captive to a given political perspective, whether that political perspective is liberal, conservative, or what have you. And I think it's very interesting to recognize, first of all, almost as a basic principle, that fear arises not when the church endorses a political position with which you agree, but that fear arises if you don't agree with what the church says or does publicly. It's at those points when somehow we say, you know, hear the church saying, as we say, hey, but that's not where I stand. It's at those points then that we end up accusing the church of playing partisan politics. So I suppose it's another case of, you know, whose ox is being gored as to who takes issue and raises the cry of you know, the church shouldn't get involved in these things. What I think that general kind of protest tends to ignore is that the church is always involved in politics, in matters political, not in a narrow sense, but those concerns that have to do with the body politic, with that have to do with our social life together as a people. And usually, or most often, that involvement has been in a way that the church unconsciously legitimizes the social order rather than challenging it. And when it does challenge it, then the church is often likely to get in trouble. Maybe with some folks out there, but more often than not with the folks who are inside the church. I think those times when the church does challenge the social order are oftentimes, though, the points when the church is being most faithful to what I think is the basic biblical vision of what our life together should be like. So we might just for a minute think of some of the levels or some of the ways in which the church goes public. And the first is probably the most basic and the most non-threatening. Namely, the church espousing certain general principles. Principles like justice and peace. And most preachers can espouse things like justice and peace again and again and again. And as long as it stays fairly abstract, they're probably not going to run into much flack. But a second level of the church going public is when the church issues certain statements or votes on certain resolutions in convention that take a given position on particular public issues, whether that is capital punishment, whether that is Central America, South Africa, whatever. Certainly a third level of the church going public is when it takes a given position on given pieces of legislation, whether that is a matter of taking a position on sanctions in South Africa or contra aid or any of the currently debated kinds of issues. And certainly at that point, insofar as those given pieces of legislation tend to fall in one camp or the other, the charges of, well, the church is getting involved in partisan politics begins to become a much stronger kind of charge at that point. I think a fourth level is a level where the church probably has not gone public that much, but certainly there are some examples of that in our own day, are when the church engages in certain actions that confront or challenge the political or the economic powers that be. And I am thinking here especially of a confrontation of the economic powers that be. And I think one of the case studies that we might have all kinds of feelings about, but I think does enter our discussion at this point, is the denominational ministry strategy, the DMS strategies in the Pittsburgh area, and the degree to which that has generated a lot of conversation, especially among Lutheran, but other Christians also. So certainly there's probably more levels than that, but just to give you an example of the array of ways in which the church goes public and at what point the church goes public, which of those levels will determine what kind of resistance and what kinds of static and all the rest are likely to arise. But I think before we get into a discussion of, well, you know, should the church do this or should the church not do that, we have to be fairly strong in saying, okay, why does the church go public? And what I would want to propose for you, and if there's one thing I hope you take from this hour, is that I think the church goes public for some very basic theological reasons. The church goes public because of our theology, because of what we believe, because of what the church is called to be. my way of looking at that is that the church is called to be a public witness, not just a private witness, but a public witness to a God who is ever active in human history. A God who is active, you know, throughout the Old Testament in the historical, economic, political dealings of the people, and a God who is revealed in Jesus the Christ. I want you to listen to just a brief passage from Luke, where I think the necessarily public dimensions of Jesus' ministry come to the fore, from Luke 7. John's disciples came to Jesus and they said, "John the Baptist sent us to ask, are you the one he said was going to come, or should we expect someone else?" At that very time, Jesus healed many people from their sicknesses, diseases, and evil spirits, and gave sight to many blind people. He answered John's messengers, "Go back and tell John what you have seen and heard." In other words, that which is publicly verifiable. "The blind can see, the lame can walk, the lepers are made clean, the deaf can hear, the dead are raised to life, and the good news is preached to the poor." So I think in that passage, and certainly one we could select a lot of other passages, Jesus' actions speak for themselves as to what faith in him entails. Not faith as simply a matter of intellectual assent, but faith as revealed through visible activity that makes a real difference in the lives of people in the world. Or, as Lutherans have often said, a faith that is active or embodied in love. Or a faith that is active or love or embodied in justice. In other words, a love whose essence is not simply a warm, fuzzy feeling, but a tough love whose essence is that of right relation or justice among people. And certainly one of the real heresies of the church that has emerged, and John Schramm in a number of his lectures last week, and I assume this week, has spoken directly to this, is the way in which we have allowed certain dualisms or dichotomies to exist where Jesus never intended such. The dichotomy between the spiritual and the bodily, and the private and the public, and all of these ways we have of thinking of a very narrow religious kind of arena that somehow is separate from all of this, rather than seeing that the religious and the spiritual is intertwined with the whole of life. There's no segmented view of human beings in the way in which we have tended to view that, and in the way in which some of that kind of thinking has crept into some of our theology at points in church history also. So I think that becomes one of the basic kinds of understandings as to how Jesus was involved in a total kind of ministry. And even though he didn't engage in a lot of confrontation with systems and structures of his day, there's a sense in which that whole understanding is a very modern kind of understanding. Nevertheless, the kinds of actions he was involved in were public kinds of actions with political ramifications. Indeed, I think we can say that Jesus lived and preached the public life deeply. And certainly his crucifixion was itself a very public event. He inaugurated a new era of God's kingdom or God's reign in human history. And if you just stop to think of all the references in the New Testament to kingdom, the kingdom of God, and Jesus continually talking about bringing the kingdom. That word kingdom is a very public, political kind of word. It's not just a very privatized notion of, me and God, but it says, hey, there's public ramifications of what this reign of God is all about. So for an increasing number of people today, that recognition that God and what God is about is known in the midst of the social realities, the economic realities, the political realities of life. And therefore, a part of the church's calling is what has often been seen as the church's prophetic calling, namely that calling to discern how God is active in this given point in history. How is God active in this breaking point in human community, when human community and that just relation that God intends for all people is broken down? How is God active in the midst of that? Any questions before I go on to the second point here?
Karen, didn't Jesus also depoliticize his kingdom talk in a way? I'm thinking specifically of John's reported conversation between Pilate and and Jesus. I'm not raising that as an argument against what you're saying, because I quite agree with what you're saying. But how do you square his depoliticizing, in a way, of his kingdom talk with what you're saying?
Certainly, I think there was that continual effort on Jesus' part to refuse to let people identify his reign with a given political order. And I think that, you know, when we get further into this, especially in terms of how we then come up with some norms and criteria, I think that becomes very important, because I think there's a tendency, whether on the left or the right, to, you know, I would say, seeing I'm not on the right, I would say especially a tendency on the right to, you know, an identity creeps in at that point. Don?
Let me jump in with two comments about that. One, John is peculiar. The kingdom only comes up a couple times in John, whereas kingdom is in the synoptics.
It's in the others.
So, and there are probable reasons why John, the community that produced John, had a different view. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that law in the Jewish kingdom, they didn't make a distinction between religious law and secular law. Mm-hmm. And so that when Jesus' disciples ate on Sunday, or healed on Sunday, or he ate with tax collectors and sinners, he was making a statement which has a... He was not just violating a religious taboo or religious traditions, he was violating the law which was thought to encompass all of society. Mm-hmm. So that even if he said it was not as of this world, it is not the sort of church-state separation that we think of today. It's,
right.
It has much more of a public... they didn't think of it in those terms.
Plus, if I could just add, the political structure is dramatically different.
Mm-hmm.
Their colony of Rome, Roman government.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus didn't lecture them to get out and change Roman policy, because that wasn't a realistic option.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Today, in a democracy, we are the governors. We have to take seriously the social admonitions and do something about it.
Well, yeah, and that whole prophetic calling of the church always needs to be contextualized. Rosemary Ruther, who's also here, and I were a part of a group of theologians last summer who were in Cuba for a week looking at the role of the church in that society, you know, and talk about dealing with a totally different kind of context. And we really struggled with some of the... an Old Testament professor, who was trying to discern, okay, what is the prophetic role of the church in this particular society? And it obviously looked quite different than what we saw as the prophetic role of the church in this society. So I think that's such a crucial kind of thing to, you know, and so often we look to the New Testament for, Jesus didn't challenge the political order in this sense, and therefore, you know, we keep our hands clean. The very language we use is, I think, very telling as to how we separate things. Any other comments along this line? Let me just go on and say a word or two as to why we, I think, have tended to to see things this way, namely this whole separation between what the church should be involved in, what the public order or what politics in its broad sense is all about. As I think has already been alluded to, one of the things that we are deeply, deeply influenced by is a whole split between the private realm of life and the public realm of life. And so what tends to happen is in contemporary American society, and I'm talking about developments that especially came to fruition in the 19th century, although certainly seeds of that prior to that, a kind of split occurs where the private is separated from the public. Home and family are seen as the realm here. Work, politics, economics, etc., become the public arena. It's very interesting, and certainly some of the kinds of feminist analysis and theologizing that's been going on in the village the last week or so is based on the understanding that it's especially women who have tended in our society to be confined to the private realm, and men seen as the actors in the public realm. Certainly there were a lot of developments in the 19th century that resulted in the church being seen as confined to this left-hand private arena in sometimes a very sentimentalized kind of way. And you know, somehow the church then keeps its fingers clean from all of that so-called dirty stuff there in the public arena. And I think a lot of our theology then has ended up serving this part of it, but we haven't always had the language of faith to deal effectively over there. My husband has often talked about how the church has specialized in the soft language of faith, whereas what we need in terms of the church going public is much more of the hard language. Language like justice, in contrast to the very soft language of love. Now, both are good kinds of language, but we have talked much more private language of faith rather than language that speaks to and deals with those public realities. One of the things that those of us in seminary are quite aware of is that we have tended to really equip people to be ministers in the private arena and have not been very effective in equipping people to deal with the public arena. Now, somebody in a position like church and society is like, oh, well, Karen is supposed to do all of that. Well, it's a rather sizable task when so much of the way in which we do theology, et cetera, has specialized in this arena. For example, we do require that future pastors go through a clinical pastor education kind of program, which occurs in a hospital or other chaplaincy kind of setting, where the main kind of thing is on the main emphasis is on a therapeutic style of ministry. Some of us, especially in the Chicago area, have under the umbrella of something called the Urban Academy, been trying to talk about what does it mean to engage in public ministry education, equipping folks to deal far more realistically and intelligently with the systems and structures of society, dealing with some of the causes of the precipitating symptoms that often present themselves here. And so the pastor ends up dealing with somebody who is struggling through a bad marriage or finds themselves unemployed and is feeling oftentimes very ill-equipped to deal with, okay, what are some of the economic developments that have impacted this community and have resulted in this unemployment? Or what are some of the tensions out there that then come down to that family unit and result in some of the problems and issues that the church has traditionally tended to preoccupy itself with? So I think it's that kind of split that has very much influenced how we have read the Bible, how we have interpreted our theology, and therefore we assume that church Bible theology has a lot to do with this over here, but not much to do with over there. And I think that's a kind of legacy, a unfortunate kind of legacy that really impedes our being more effective when the church goes public. That's certainly a social, cultural kind of factor as to why we have tended to see things this way. There's certainly a number of aspects of our theology that I think have fed into this also. But for Lutherans in particular, one of the theological inheritances that has been somewhat ambiguous and not too helpful for us has been Luther's understanding of the two kingdoms. And there have been all kinds of understandings of what two kingdoms meant. Basically, the shorthanded way that many people often talk about it is, well, there's a spiritual realm and there's a secular realm, and even though God has something to do with both, it's like, well, never the twain shall meet, and etc. Now, that's really a caricature of what I think Luther was trying to get at, but that's often been the way we've understood it, and in a way that falls exactly into this kind of split. So, well, the spiritual realm, that has to do with the private, and the public realm, the secular realm, that has to do with the public, and that's the left hand of God, and the other is the right hand of God, and all that sort of thing. And so we dichotomized those two ways in which God is involved with the world, rather than properly seeing God's secular and spiritual governance as dialectically related in a common struggle against sin, evil, injustice, all those things that separate people from God and from one another. So what happens is, instead of seeing those two working together, we dichotomize them and see spiritual, religious, and private issues of faith and salvation on one hand, and on the other, secular, social, political issues that have to do with God's preservation of all of creation. But we see that stuff over there as not really impinging directly on the heart of what faith is all about. And so when Luther's two kingdoms understandings or caricatures of it are applied, any would-be activism or any sense in which the church goes public or becomes involved in political issues, we are quickly informed, is not central to the basic issue of faith. It's peripheral, to be affirmed, but not really required. And what we overlook in interpreting Luther through this kind of framework is that Luther himself was deeply engaged in social political struggles of his day. His theology was quite political in its ramifications. Now, I'm not saying he intended it to be that way always, but our Luther scholar probably have a comment.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Can I have a couple minutes?
Sure.
The two kingdoms, as you described it, is Augustinian, not Lutheran, although there are perversions of it. Luther talks about two ways of ruling the world, the zwei Regimente, two reigns.
Right.
One is the spiritual and the other is the worldly. God operates in both, and Christians are in both reigns, are involved in both. When they're operating in the spiritual, then they deal specifically with spiritual things, but they also have responsibilities as Christians in the world ruled by God through government. Now, in Luther's day, it was princes or city councils that ruled, and Luther then argued they were ordained by God, and therefore you should obey them because they are ordained by God. In our society, however, you could take Luther's theology without any changes at all, and because we argue that the government is based upon the consent of the governed, and that we as individuals have the right and the responsibility to see that we are, to participate in government, Lutheran theology fits directly into the notion that we have the responsibility to exercise as Christians in God's reign of the secular world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens with Luther, you have to distinguish between Luther and Lutheranism, because
right.
Lutheranism in Germany ends up with the division between well, the women, Kirche, Kuchen, and Kinder is over in the private side, you know, the kitchen, church, and children, and women are all supposed to be going together, and then the public, and you weren't supposed to step over it. But Luther, the reason Luther himself could be so active politically and his movement could be so political is that he saw God operating in both.
Right.
God had chosen two swords, two ways of ruling the world, spiritual and secular. It was important to keep them apart. In other words, to use the spiritual to determine what you're supposed to do in the secular was often led to confusion and difficulty. For that reason, he opposed a crusade.
Mm-hmm.
He said it was illegitimate to use Christ as an excuse to go kill your neighbor, you know, a non-Christian. Then, on the other hand, as a Christian, you have a responsibility in the secular world to participate in God's rule of that particular sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Well, that's actually what I was getting to, you know, because I was trying to review some of the characterizations
yeah.
of that, you know, which you're right. Yeah, it was very Augustinian kind of understanding, but that's what we've then applied, and I think these popular notions of a separation without seeing God's rule in both
is what
in a sense you just completed what I was going to be making my next point, but that's fine. That was a clarifying way of going about that. I think it's very interesting to realize that the heart of Luther's theology came to the fore when he really was in the process of challenging some of those powers that really were holding people's conscience in bondage. Now, for him, that was especially the institution of the papacy, and unfortunately, at that point, we get into a lot of anti-Roman Catholic polemic, which, you know, is not my point for mentioning that. But his seeing the papacy as a very strong economic, social, political power over people's lives, and therefore challenging that institutional reality, became for him a fairly basic kind of issue of faith. And there's also evidence in some of the lesser known writings of Luther of his, for example, lashing out in about 1524 against what were some of the very, very early precursors of what now are the multinational corporations. And basically he ended up saying, well, you know, if you cooperate with them, you know, you're really compromising God's justice and righteousness. That's not a literal kind of translation of what he was saying. But those who would say that, you know, Luther never had any political involvements, or if he did, it was only in terms of opposing the peasants' revolt, which is usually what is thrown in the face of Lutherans at that point, I think are really missing the boat in terms of what Luther himself actually was living out and doing in his own day. So I think for those of us Lutherans, I recognize there's many of us in the village who aren't, but I think we especially have some problems at times trying to look at the church going public. I think we need to recognize that kind of tension and that distinction that was just outlined here that Luther was trying to get at when he talked about two ways in which God rules the world provide a kind of critical perspective for us to stand over and against any public or social or political order. The difficulty is that Lutherans historically have more often used this part of our theology and our tradition to keep us out of trouble with the powers that be in the world, rather than to get us into the kind of trouble in which the prophets and Jesus and a few others found themselves in when they tried to challenge injustice in their day. So for me, the following criteria becomes really important in terms of how we draw on that part of our theological tradition. If two kingdoms is used to legitimate privileges of the church or of a definite social group in society, then it can very quickly become heretical, a heretical ideology. But if, especially in situations of crisis or suffering, it is used to cooperate with God for salvation and justice for all, and I'm thinking especially justice for those who are the oppressed in the world, then I think it's biblical and its Reformation understanding is rediscovered. Another perspective, John Schramm this morning was quoting a Quaker, so I feel some freedom to quote a Quaker also. Another person who has talked a lot about the church going public is a man by the name of Parker Palmer, who has written a book, A Company of Strangers, and that it's available in the bookstore. I didn't bring it along today. But he does a lot of talking a lot of outlining of the situation today where the church really does need to see itself much more as a community that is a public community. He diagnoses our present situation as one where we spend a lot of time and energy saying, well, you know, we want intimate bonds of fellowship. And he says, well, okay, that has its place. But let's also talk about the church being that peculiar institution that has, as part of its calling, reaching out and trying to connect with those who are the strangers, and the realm of the public being the realm of the strangers. When we're out there in the world of the public, you know, we're interacting with all kinds of people who we probably don't know on a very intimate basis, and maybe we don't want to know on a very intimate basis. And Palmer, I think, makes a very good case for why the church needs to think much more publicly in terms of its calling and in terms of the language of faith that it uses. He says at one point, the kingdom comes when those we think of as strangers become our brothers and sisters. When we can embrace the contradictions and the conflicts of public life with familial compassion, when we can feel at ease dealing with the tensions and ambiguities and all the rest that are a part of the public arena. So he would call us to enter the public and to engage with those who are the strangers in our midst. Certainly one of the biblical stories that comes to mind at that point is the familiar parable of the Good Samaritan. And the fact that, you know, the Samaritan was seen as the good neighbor because of going out of his way in order to become a neighbor with the one who was the stranger. So the third point I want to make, and then I want to open this up for a kind of freewheeling kind of discussion, just a word or two as to why it is necessary for the church to go public in our own day. I think the primary reason is that in modern times we are increasingly conscious of how our systems, how systems and structures out there, those systems and structures that we associate with the public arena, shape our most intimate and personal relations. And therefore, we need to think about the kinds of diseases, the kinds of ills that beset us. I'm not talking just about physical ills, but psychological ills, the whole gamut, as being very much related to the way in which things are structured in our society. One of the other reasons in which I see this very, well, one of the ways in which I see this really coming to the fore in pastoral ministry, and it certainly became very evident in the years that I spent as a parish pastor, and I guess that's why I still think in these ways, is that there is a very intimate connection between what we think of as pastoral, the caring for people, the living deeply with their pain, and the prophetic dimension of ministry. Oftentimes we separate that and say, well, you know, pastoral, that's when you care for people, and prophetic, that's when you speak out and challenge the structures, etc. I think the best parish pastors are also the most prophetic parish pastors, who live deeply with the pain of their people. And from out of that immersion in their pain, which I think has a lot to do with what it means to believe in a God who immerses him or herself in the pain of the people, from out of that engagement, we can't help but reach the point of saying, okay, why is it this way? You know, what needs to be changed? Is simply putting on more Band-Aids or giving more food through our food pantry enough? Or do we need to become more public in terms of addressing those realities that shape the problem and you know, rather than just dealing with the symptoms? Another factor that comes into play is that spiritual crises emerge in the midst of social structural realities. I am continually struck by the fact that issues of faith or unfaith don't just emerge in an abstract Bible study kind of thing, but they emerge when we're really in the midst of the fray, when we're really contending with, well, what does it mean to get by in this situation? You know, what does it mean for us, for our church to address this problem or that problem? And all of a sudden, people's resistance goes up and we realize, well, you know, even though we might all say we're Christians, there's a lot of other values that tug at us at times, whether it's bottom line kind of thinking or, well, you know, this is what's important to me. And when those values get challenged, we get pretty nervous at times. And I think it's at those points that some real spiritual crises emerge, and we have to say, okay, where really is our faith? What are some of the idolatries that tend to preoccupy us at times, even though we might not at times want to acknowledge them? We discover that, hey, there's some other things that compete for allegiance in our lives besides some of our basic faith commitments. Faithfulness, obedience, and holiness, I would furthermore suggest, all those things we connect with our faith have a necessarily social dimension. And here is where the predominant way we have of thinking of ourselves in American society, namely as individuals, in a very individualistic sense, thinking of ourselves as individuals is not so bad, but when it becomes an extreme form of individualism, then I think the church needs to raise some questions about that, because the biblical understanding is a far more social understanding of what human life is all about. And here I'm making a very close connection between that which is social and that which is public and that which is political. We could get into a discussion of the differences, but for our purposes here, I'm seeing a real continuity between those. When we think of the social dimensions of life, that necessarily involves us with thinking of the whole polis, the whole political arena, not just in terms of electoral politics, but what it means for us to live together as a society. That's the kind of thing that I'm referring to when I think of public or political. One person who's done some writing on this, a Roman Catholic by the name of Paul Steidelmeyer, has this to say. If we think of the social aspect of life purely as extrinsic, as something apart from who we basically are as individuals, then our only concern with it is to keep the waters calm and to avoid shipwreck. But if we see the social aspect of life as an intrinsic part of the human heart, if those dimensions of life so intimately shape who we are, then we can no longer treat them merely as a context for which some type of social action may be appropriate. Rather, they present us with the neighbor and with a way of touching the inner depths of his or her heart. Our social relations, our relations in the public, out there, the political dimensions of what we're about, become the touchstone for discerning what our spirituality is about in the world. Namely, they point us toward a deeper commitment to and a deeper involvement in those justice issues that are a part of the public arena. So I think part of what we need to do is think through a lot of our theological concepts with far more social meaning than we have. Most of the time, we tend to think of, well, salvation, that's a matter between God and me. And as long as that's okay, then everything else will take care of itself. Salvation, if we look at it across the whole biblical spectrum, has far more of a social dimension to it than we have often understood being the case. There have been a number of other connections that have been made that would say this is necessary. The personal is necessarily political, is a kind of phrase that has especially come out of the women's movement. But a number of ways in which we have to, I think, reappropriate and reinterpret how we've understood some of our theology and understanding of the church, because we've seen it in a truncated kind of way and through a kind of lens that has often not been very helpful for making some connections with the public. So let me just stop at that point, and actually that's longer than I wanted to talk, but there'll be further time to talk later on. Comments, questions, issues for you, just in terms of getting this issue on the table, which is about all we've been able to do this day.
What you're saying, theologically, I understand, and I learned that going through student days. But what I've found in the last 20 years in the congregation is people who, by and large, don't understand the theology of the Lutheran Church, even though they're Lutheran. And who I find have great resistance to any kind of active public dimension being discussed anywhere within the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
Tried numerous times in three different parishes that I belong to start some kind of social ministry or some kind of discussion, even in the softest kind of language, and it doesn't happen. In Portland, about 8 years ago, we had a meeting of business people. Top business people in the community who happen to be Lutheran. And basically, within 3 days of two-hour meetings, there was a general consensus that the congregation and the church had little or any impact on their lives in their public dimension, because it was just too far removed from their reality. And I put that out because it's so frustrating to hear you talk about it and realize how different the reality is, mm-hmm. in terms of an active parishioner.
Well, that's why I think most of the time we have not sufficiently accounted for the powerful impact that some of these social cultural factors, this whole split between the private and public, have had. So that, quite commonly the usual response is, well, that's politics, or and church and state don't mix, and we have
some
very...
I guess what I'm saying is that the congregation is a long ways behind where you're talking about, from my experience.
You feel that you've failed, perhaps, in communicating this to
No, I feel like certain people have heard me, and I have gathered those people around me in one way or the other, and we have had our impact through the kind of work that I do and so forth, but in terms of any success with the congregation or with having this become more of a reality in the lives of the broader congregation, I feel like it's a failure, yes.
Yeah.
For
Jerry Falwell's a complete success. And he's very public, but I don't think
yeah.
he got that either.
Yeah, I know.
Or Pat Robertson.
But that's not public theology to me.
I think, you know, some of the things that people are saying, well, indicate that the church has already had its impact long before you got there. And that's what it's saying. But, you know, you were talking back when you were a parish priest, parish pastor. Mm-hmm. You know, in some settings where the majority of the counseling, you're seeing sort of a societal thing that, you know, that basically everybody in between the ages of 25 and 35 who are coming in, it boils down to one specific, basically community in which I live, where everybody gets married before they're 20. They have their divorce by the time they're 25, and then they have a couple of kids. And it's just sort of a strange a setting that would really, you know, well, I was a little frustrated when there was something with somebody that female needed some counseling, and all I said was, well, we could, but, you know, why don't you go down to, going for alcohol treatment, you know, because that's about all there is for women. And women make business, you know, made a couple of women, yeah, you know, that's all there is for women. And it's a, you know, the whole social setting is, well, 1886, it would probably be progressive, but I lost that in 1936. But, you know, in that point, if you're the, counseling minister, I think it does move, you know, there is something that it might not, you might not do it right away. You have to identify, you know, on a larger scale, that this is happening to everybody here, and it's causing, you know, economic problems, it's causing all your social problems, and wife beating, and child neglect, and child abuse. And at that point, you know, you really, you're taking a stand based on your corporate need, in addition to your theology, which is something in that effect where the whole community is. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to argue, or just to act as the devil's advocate for a moment. You mentioned Robertson and moral majority. Well, I mean, Falwell. Well, also the Robertson and running for president. There's a real danger that what they do is they identify certain positions as being a Christian. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a danger in saying that the church should be taking positions and labeling them, these are the Christian positions.
I agree.
What the church needs to do is energize and inform its members so that the members then can act as citizens to take positions within the community. And when I say educate, that means bring out issues of justice, of responsibility, internationally and domestically.
You get them out of law and into the gospel.
Yeah. But I would be very nervous and am very nervous with the religious right and taking positions and saying these are the Christian positions and this is what the Christian thing to do has to be. You mentioned Luther and the peasants. The reason Luther attacked the peasants was not because he did not support their economic and political goals. He did support them. Mm-hmm. He attacked them because they said that the gospel mandated that these things had to happen, and they took up the sword in the name of Christ to bring these about. And he said at that point, you're perverting the gospel and to hell with you, quite literally. Mm-hmm. I think the same thing is happening with people on the religious right are saying this is the Christian position. They're picking up whatever they can to force that on the rest of us. And I think that's a perversion of Christianity too.
But then if what you're saying is that we need to really define further, Karen, what is that you mean when you say the church goes public? Are you talking about the individual member of the church, in which I feel fairly successful in that area?
Yeah,
or are you talking about the congregation as an organization or groups of people who proclaim themselves as a congregation?
Yeah, I was talking about more in that corporate sense.
Yeah, you see, I think corporately we're in that same place that he's saying, that I feel almost there's danger in that. It's more like what we have to do is educate various individuals within the church and hope that they will be more effective in their living.
Isn't there two dangers there? One is that you wrap your political views and a thin veneer of theology and then you call it religion. There is another danger, however, in just saying, okay, we avoid responsibility by saying, you go out and do good, and you do not take specific stands. And it seems to me the Roman Catholic bishops have handled this well in taking a corporate stand on mm-hmm. question of the whole nuclear weapons race. They're not saying we're right, every Roman Catholic has to agree with us, or this is the Catholic stand or the Christian stand, but they're doing more than just piously saying go out and do good. I think there are two things to avoid, and I think the Lutherans generally, we have, our danger has been that we have just said to people go out and do good, and as a result, we haven't done much good.
But it's like we're not hierarchically organized enough to do what the Catholic bishops have done. I mean, we do have statements that we create in the national offices someplace, I guess, or mm-hmm. some group someplace creates a statement about abortion or whatever. But I agree with you. I really like what the Catholic bishops have done.
Yeah, I don't think is our problem is the corporate structure. I think our problem is we haven't moved to the point, we haven't had enough lectures like this from Karen that we have moved to the point where we're ready.
I think that there are a lot of things that an individual can't do that the corporate can do. And the obvious example is the sanctuary movement, where an individual can't offer sanctuary, but a church can.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a lot more power than the individual members of it.
I came in late, but what you said just perked my ears up. So I want to respond to one of that. Tomorrow, in terms of the church and the community organization movement, one of the things that Karen and I will address, just what you said, is that how does the church and its teachings and the gospel's value become effective citizenship? And secondly, in terms of the Lutheran church, I remember reading a comment by an LCA theologian, William Lazarus, be exact, when he was speaking at the Arsalan Convention of the Lutheran World Federation, where he said that the Lutheran Church should be a church that makes moral statements, but is not a maker of moral strategy. And he just was jumped on by every third world church there by saying that's just our problem as the Lutheran Church in South Africa or wherever it may be, or even in the Eastern Bloc, is that we make moral statements, but we have never been a church of moral strategy. And I think that's the difficulty, is how the Lutherans, giving all the pitfalls that you raised, become a church that devises moral strategy, carries out those resolutions. Otherwise, they're just that.
Yeah.
Some of you may want to run off to supper, but some of you want to continue discussing.
But if you're politically active and you are not in the moral majority and you are on the opposite side, I am politically active. And very, very cautious about making any Christian statement because you're going to be identified as a nut real fast.
It's almost as if that which bears the explicit Christian label is the most needs to be the most suspect by Christians.